So I want to welcome everyone this evening. This is the second talk of the five aggregates. And as I mentioned during the first talk, I think this series has an awful lot to say about how we lose our sense of, where we place our sense of identification. And what the Buddha saw was that there are bundles of experience in which we sort of give over or release and give over to that bundle as being a sense of a personal representation of self, of I'm your mind. And as we've been spending a couple of weeks, this is the third week on the topic, I've been getting some emails from some of you as you are unbundling. And the joy some of you express in your ability to do that. So it's fun to see that coming. And if you're working with it seriously, it can be a remarkable experience as we study the nature of how this mind and body process is put together so that we claim ownership to it. And really, again, as we look at these five aggregates, the point is to look at them with some objectivity so that we can begin to discern whether, in fact, there's an entity that abides within these bundles or not. And this particular bundle that we are going to be discussing tonight is on feelings. In Pali, the word is vedana. Now, feelings doesn't mean emotions as it does in the West, but rather it is the a pleasant quality of an experience or an unpleasant quality of an experience or a neutral tone or feeling tone to an experience. So feelings represent one of those three tones, pleasant, unpleasant, or neither unpleasant nor pleasant, which is we call neutral tones. And it's fascinating when you begin to unravel how an experience comes to fruition. Because the root of this conditioning, how we condition ourselves, is based upon whether an experience we're having, inward, internal experience, or external, has a pleasant quality to it. And if it does, we rush in. And if it doesn't, we flee and are often, we hold an accompanying fear response to it. And if it's neither pleasant nor unpleasant, we dismiss it as being not worth paying attention to. Now, first we have to understand or get a sense that every experience has a feeling tone. And that feeling tone is not in the object, it's in us. We place that feeling tone upon the object and then chase after the object with all of our tenacity and purpose, when really what we're chasing after is the feeling tone that's abiding in us, that we're having. It's very interesting, and it gets crazier and crazier as this talk goes on. But So give a sense. I mean, just as we're sitting here, I mean, whether the room's temperature, for instance, is it pleasant to you? Is it unpleasant, or are you even noticing it? And as you look out among the faces here, notice some that you call friend, which started from the root of having a pleasant relationship, pleasant connection, or ones that you might have some disagreement and that you have this feeling tone of unpleasantness, or some you don't know and thereby you dismiss. And so we get down to this root base of how we experience the world. Someone on retreat, I was in Portland this last weekend, and somebody on the retreat was telling me about his job and how difficult his job is, and he keeps getting lost and in the job, and how he just hates the job. But when I asked him, he doesn't hate all aspects of the job. But when he looks at the summation of the job, he says he doesn't like it. So I said, well, since you readily admit there are parts of it you like and parts of it you don't, start noticing the feeling tone rather than the reaction. From the reaction, which is the eruption of Mount St. Helens, you can't, it's hard to come to any kind of stability once the eruption has occurred. But if you release yourself from the eruption of the reaction and go to the feeling tone, you can quite likely decipher and discern what parts of the job you are attracted to, what parts of the job you're not, and what parts of the job you don't care about. And notice then how one feeling tone begins to incorporate itself or merge into others. But keep them very distinct as you begin to see this. And you'll see that throughout the day, part of the job is very delightful to you, which I knew was in his case. And so if we break down our experience, oftentimes the experience, the reaction that we've had, can be very recoverable. We can get our feet back on the ground when we deal with just the pleasant or unpleasant tone of it. We can't when we lose ourselves in the full-bodied reactivity that is long after the feeling tone and the embellishment of that feeling tone, and we're off to the races in our thinking. And I'll go more in detail on that in just a moment. But I want to draw your attention to something that is extraordinarily important, especially during this particular time in our history, but also other times as well. And that is that there are certain forces in the culture that have learned how to condition you through your feeling tones. Marketing, for instance. I just saw the movie The Corporation. Interesting movie, and I recommend it for those who haven't seen. But one part of it was really disturbing to me. Well, it was all rather disturbing to me, but one part of it was more than passively disturbing, and that was where they were saying how they focus market on infants, so that if they can get the infant or the toddler to associate, and they do this very deliberately, a product with a feeling tone, then they know that that feeling tone will stay with them for the duration of their life. And they do this by many, many means. Many of us who grew up in the 50s didn't have that kind of devious marketing, really. It was kind of innocent, you know, Cheerios and that, you know, Frost, you know, it wasn't. But these are that groups of people decide how to hook the young child into this feeling tone so that they will then hook to the product. And they know, for instance, and this is part of the whole marketing strategy too, that 40% of all the toys that are purchased by children are purchased because of the nagging quality of the child. So if they can invoke that nagging quality child around this particular object, then they can get the parent 40% of the time to purchase the object. We have to know what's happening to us here. Also, in the political realm, the ads, the rather unpleasant advertisement of whatever party showing another party in a altered or uncomfortable or unpleasant light. You see, what we pick up from that, we begin to associate the unpleasantness with the image. And even though we may not believe it intellectually, we may dismiss the logic of the ad. The unpleasantness paired with the image stays. And so then you begin to have this emotional resonance with the candidate through the negative advertisement. You may not like the negative advertisement, but it works in terms of conditioning your feeling tone. Now, unless we're aware of this, we are puppets to marketing That's what I felt when I saw this movie. I thought, oh my God, I'm a puppet to this. I thought I had some discernment, but really I don't. You know, I make all of the comfortable choices and product identification that I have been taught to make. And so now when I'm going into a store, and I just started doing this, I'm watching my feeling tone. And I'm not believing it. Tied. And I don't believe it. Why should I believe it? It is a conditioned phenomenon. Anything that conditioning not only is it conditioned, but whatever is conditioned, I mean, over time we have just learned to associate one feeling tone with a product. But if we also know that that's occurring and are willing to counter it by actually experiencing the product firsthand and noticing what our direct experience feeling tone is, often you can dissipate that old product and marketing and conditioning. Like, I grew up in a family that the parents didn't like lima beans. So I never really tasted lima beans, but we never had them, and I just assumed they weren't any good. So that happened well into my adulthood. You know, I just didn't eat them. I said, well, this is silly. I don't even remember what they taste like. So then I started tasting them, and I really tried to approach it without the memory, which holds the feeling tone. Let me just taste this. And you have to be open to doing that, you see. But most of us aren't. Most of us just run with the feeling. I'll say, okay, I don't care what my memory says. Let me taste this thing. And now they're fine. I don't mind them. I kind of have a neutral. So other people, it's not just you that are conditioning these feeling tones through your liking and not liking and through your direct experience, but also that's what the whole business of advertising is, to give you a pleasant feeling tone associated with the product, even though you may never have tried the product. So if we begin to understand how the building blocks of this conditioned phenomena called self, on what it's based, we can then really make our lives independent of those forces, tremendous forces of mind. Tremendous forces of the culture. Tremendous forces. The Buddha said at one point he realized that all he was seeking in life was pleasant feelings. All he was seeking, that everything he was running after amounted to a pleasant feeling. So I dare say that if we look at our own experience, we would find the same tendency, that in the avoidance of the unpleasant feeling tone. So this is a sobering talk, but one that I think is desperately needed in this time and place in society. Now, when a feeling tone gets embellished with a thought, and an image within in that thought, then an emotional context comes around that feeling tone. And that feeling tone that started out unpleasant will often accompany itself into unpleasant thoughts and unpleasant emotions. And the emotion may be irritation or annoyance or fear or anger or something, in which that feeling tone has then been embellished sufficiently so it becomes a full-blown emotion. Now, many times in our daily active life, we're not going to be able to develop the subtlety of knowing the feeling tone. We're going to feel the full-blown emotion. And we can enter the conditioned link, the chain of events, called dependent origination in Buddhism. Wherever we enter the chain of events, we always have the ability to release ourselves, to unhook that chain. So I think that the entry point for most lay people is the emotional link, where emotions are felt. That usually gets our attention. Although pleasant emotions don't so much, unpleasant emotions do. We like the pleasant ones, we want to sustain those, never realizing that we're being conditioned all along the way through those pleasant emotions. But the unpleasant ones usually get our attention. The point is to bring out or decipher the feeling tone associated with the emotion, and to be able not to get into the full-blown embellishment of the thought associated with the emotion, but to go back to the simplicity of the feeling tone. Okay, I can feel this. Let me just, this irritation is basically unpleasant. See, what we're trying to do is we're trying to convert it, which is one of the insidious qualities that many meditators develop over a long length of time in their meditation, is that they're not willing to face the feeling tone on its own. They're still doing what the Buddha said, seeking pleasant feelings in life. And so we think that meditation, through some kind of alchemy, we can have an irritated feeling, and if we just stay with it long enough, somehow some kind of chemistry will develop, so this will be a pleasant tone. So some of us spend a long time in our practice waiting for the pleasantness to arrive and putting up with the unpleasantness while it's there. Well, we have to see through that. That's not meditation. We're not trying to lean into life one way as opposed to another. When we do so, we are essentially dismissing one half of life. The point is to open up to things as they are, with the feeling tone, however it is, not to try to convert one feeling tone into another. How many of us have sat with a pain in the knee, waiting for that pain to dissipate, trying to do all the different strategies that we have learned in meditation so that that pain can go away and for us to have a pleasant meditation, which means one that has pleasant feeling tones? When are we going to wake up to the fact that this mind, this experience of awareness, is not dependent upon feeling tones at all? What it's dependent upon is knowing what's arising, not dependent upon certain conditions arising. And so watch your meditation, especially the sense of self-dislike, which I have a renewed respect for how embedded it is within us. We think that we can, when we have a sense of unworthiness arise, that if we just stay with that unworthiness, somehow we will at some point come out to really liking ourselves. And that we just need to apply the right strategy, the right patience, and that will, in fact, occur. No, the point is to see that unworthiness and whatever and however it manifests as simply untrue of our connection, of our dependency at all. Not to try to convert it into a nice, friendly, pleasant sense of me, which is just another feeling tone, but to see the untruth of it and to release the attached response we have with it by seeing that untruth. And thereby, impersonal, making that very personal unworthiness impersonal by just releasing it to be itself, but without my grasping it as me, I, me, or mine. So when we look at feeling tones, we're really looking at the bedrock of how all problems arise in our life. It's quite amazing. The Buddha said, based upon contact, there will be a feeling tone. We cannot get out of that. That's hardwired into the nature of experience, that there will be a feeling tone associated with every experience. Based upon the nature of that feeling tone, there will be a grasping or a wanting more of it, which is the next dependent chain in the next link in the chain, a moving towards it, a grasping, a reaching, or an aversive response for an unpleasant one in which we will draw back trying to avoid it, or we won't notice it at all, which is the neutral response. Based upon that grasping or avoiding comes a whole sense of logic, inward logic and thought associated with that feeling tone. I want more. Oh, the last time I had this, I just had the greatest time. I can't wait to have this again. And this is that whole proliferation of thought that holds the image. And the image is embedded within the feeling tone. So by thinking about it, we're promoting the feeling tone to last longer than its natural duration, so that we can take an experience that is transient and milk it with our thoughts to milk the feeling tone to last longer than the experience will last. Or we can have a thought that where the experience isn't even at hand, like a sexual play in the mind, sexual image. And you just play it out, even though as a monk, completely celibate, no possibility of transgressing that precept, and my mind would just... But it was never satisfactory, obviously, because it was always... It was just a feeling tone. I was just milking a feeling tone. And you get that the unsatisfactory quality, because the desire can never come to any kind of satisfaction, obviously. And so thoughts can never come to any kind of satisfaction. When they are separated from the experience of life, which most thoughts are, all we're pursuing through the thinking is the feeling tone embedded within the thought. And now all of us have had the experience when we're sitting and meditating, following our breath, rising, falling, and we have a thought, and the thought seems so much more interesting, so much more inviting, so much more pleasant than the breath, which is neutral, usually, in feeling tone. Which one are we going to go to? Well, I'm not staying. Why would I stay with my breath? Or maybe, this is a good one, for the more sophisticated you become, you can keep one eye on the thought and a half an eyeball on the breath and pretend like you're really doing a full sitting. Because we love the experience of being pleasant. Our life runs towards that. It hopes, it wishes, there's a deep sense of gratification and expectation for the meaning of life to be one in which pleasantness will be predominant. And there's an enormous amount of grief we feel when we understand that that is not the way it is. That it can never be that way. It's very sobering when you realize that all the problems in your life are not because you've made a mistake, any more than the joys in your life are because you've done something right. That's the nature of life itself. Period. And for us to be able to handle it on its own terms, pleasant and unpleasant. Now that's not a dispassion or a disassociation or a detached way of seeing. It invites a very affected and intimate seeing. It just doesn't hold on to the... It's like a rope, you know, that's being pulled along all the time and you're just trying to grasp it. It's running through your hands. And for us to just, okay, you know, I can't do this anymore. I can't keep running after all this. I can't walk into grocery stores with product identification pulling me on each counter. I'm not going to vote because some image on the screen has induced a negative response. I know nothing about this person. Only what their opponent wants me to know about them. Well, I dare say Every one of us could have an opponent that would put us off the map of electability. I'm not going to do that. We have to be stronger than, more sane than that. And the way we hold feeling tones, it's real interesting. I mean, we'll have an experience with someone. Perhaps it hasn't been a very pleasant experience. But we'll hold that feeling tone with that person for the, quite likely for the duration of our relationship with them. I had a wonderful relationship with someone. This is the power of wise speech and unwise speech. A wonderful relationship in which we just delighted in each other's company. And then a friend of mine, who was also a friend of this third person, all three of us are now teachers, by the way, but this didn't happen at a time when we were teachers. She said, he said to me about her something disparaging. And it was a judgment. And then I could not see that person free of that other person's judgment anymore. And it led to a different kind of relationship with the person. It's so interesting how we give each other the feeling tone of through association, through our judgment, through our opinions, through our ideas. Because we think that it's true. We don't realize that the person never contains the feeling tone. We contain the feeling tone. No one's good or pleasant or unpleasant as themselves. It's only our mind's conditioned response. Our mind's conditioned response to that person that makes the pleasant or the unpleasant. It's like color. The object does not contain color. Light contains color and reflects off the object. But when we see something that's colorful, we say, oh, I like the purple or the burgundy zafu. That's exactly the same thing. The object does not contain the feeling tone. We contain the feeling tone and we give it to the object, but we embed it in the object externally and then relate to it as if it has that feeling tone. It doesn't. And then we can hand it off to other people through association, through our opinion. Now, the more affluent a culture is, the more we're going to be dependent upon the feeling tone. Because what affluence buys you is the propensity or the possibility of pleasantness. So when we are very affluent, which this culture is, then we are going to have a harder time coming to terms with the feeling tones of life. We're not going to like them so much. And we keep trying to refine what pleasure is. And in our refinement of what pleasure is, by definition, we are refining and enlarging the unpleasant. Because when we say that it's not just any wine that will do, but it has to be the 1942 vintage from southern France, then any other vintage or year from any other area of the country doesn't hold up to that particular Burgundy. You see, by defining and refining our pleasant feeling tones, we are thereby casting a greater sense of unpleasantness. You go to India, they don't do that. They live right with the unpleasant, I guarantee you. And you can see it out on the streets. We go to India and we're in disgust. Seeking pleasure. You see, the other thing it doesn't allow us to do when we refine our need for pleasantness is it never allows us to feel completely content. Another way of saying that, it never allows us to feel like we belong in this moment. Because we think we have the power, and an affluent culture like ours has a very strong sense of control. And so, having engendered that within us, when we find a particular unpleasant moment, we're not going to abide there. We're going to get up and call the person to fix the problem of the heat or the this or the that, or do it ourselves, or yell at somebody because he didn't do it. But we aren't going to learn to be content with it. Now you're beginning to see, I hope, how important this particular aggregate is. Because basically, watch what you react to. I mean, after you've stopped blaming the person out there for the feeling tone with your anger, and you begin to own the anger, you begin to see that all the blame came because the anger has a very unpleasant feeling tone associated with it, and we don't want to own that. We don't want to take responsibility for that. We don't want to have to open to that, so we'll take it and cast it out on this other person and say the unpleasant feeling tone of anger is because of you. So that's the madness of projection. The madness of life, really. And thereby, if we think that we can keep purifying the pleasant quality of life, what does that lead to but a culture which has a very strong tendency towards perfectionism, where the pleasant isn't pleasant enough because it hasn't reached the ideal pleasantness? That's a very discontented culture. A very frenetic culture. We're looking for the perfect feeling. And we begin to see, you know, how our thoughts, our attempts to proliferate the feeling outward. Or, if it's an unpleasant thought, then we try to escape the unpleasant by creating more and more fantasies or fictions around that, rather than merely seeing whether the thought is pleasant or unpleasant and dealing with it at that level. It's very hard to deal with life once it becomes complex. Once it becomes very detailed, very very abstract, differentiated. Then, in relationship, you don't know who said that and what you're in there and what the other person, and it's like all muddled and you don't. That. Why not just go to the feeling tone? Immediately, the bottom drops out of the argument. We take responsibility for our emotions, unpleasant as they may be. And we don't count on the other person to bring the pleasant feeling tone into my life, which is the whole root of dependency. And we learn how to abide with a feeling tone that's present. You know, our relationship with the world is really for the feeling tone it gives us rather than for connection itself. Think of that. we're not really interested in connecting. We're interested in connecting pleasantly. Let us not fool ourselves when we talk about interconnection. The interconnection is based upon a feeling tone. And that life will just be this big, wonderful, pleasant amoeba. I had amoebic dysentery. When is it going to be about connecting? Regardless of feeling tone. Because that's where true connection lies. Not if we stop at the feeling tone. If we stop at the feeling tone, we will like the situation, the person, the event, the experience, as long as that feeling tone can remain pleasant. That long. And then we'll move on to a new partner, to a new relationship, when it is no longer satisfactory. Now, each feeling tone, we each have a predisposition to move with one feeling tone as opposed to another. And I know when Sharon was here, she talked about the personality types, and I left the homework sheet on these personality types. We can have fun with this thing. It doesn't have to be such a... It doesn't have to be so fraught with seriousness. But I'd just like to talk just a little bit about how, as an individual, we can have a predisposition for one particular feeling tone as opposed to another. And so there, in the Visuddhimagga, which is a commentary on the Buddhist suttas, they talk about the three personality types. The greedy type, that's the person who is enamored more than the average person with pleasant feelings and wants everything to be pleasant. And therefore, the attitude or the way that we look at life is optimistic and very rosy. And really can't harbor the other side, the pessimistic side, despite the reality of the situation. And they always find some bright thing to say. They're fun, they're easy to be around, but they drive you a little nuts. Now, all of these different personalities, we are a blend of all these different personalities. So none of you are just one as opposed to the other. In fact, when I looked at this, it was years, I thought I was all three, which we all are. But and it said that in the person who's has that propensity for seeking out the pleasant, not only is optimistic, but has a kind of way that they hold themselves in that kind of cheerful way, always sees life, you know, the advantages that it's going to provide, et cetera, et cetera. Then there's the aversive type. The aversive type is the type just the opposite, who has a lot, looks at the what's going to go wrong, how the whole thing is going to break apart. This is my style. Don't ask me how the elections are going to go. So someone of that, with that characteristic, you know, is a little more serious, not as light about things, and a little more hot, perhaps less confident in the future, etc. And then there is the deluded personality type that doesn't really have any opinion about whether how life is going to go, and is sort of muddled in his or her opinions and not very kind of messy in how they keep life in themselves without a great deal of discernment along the way. So I invite an exploration, an investigation of whatever type you see you have a preponderance for. And just this week, as you're working with it, start noticing that feeling tone. As opposed to just, you know, everything's going to be okay. Just look at the wish for pleasantness, the drive for pleasantness, the drive, the need for pleasant, or the aversion for the unpleasant. Or just notice how dazed you are in life. Now, finally, I just want us to get to the point where we begin to understand the importance of noticing these different feelings that are arising. That literally, our awareness depends upon that. For it is a knee-jerk response from the feeling tone to the embellished thought. And for us to back it off so that we can begin to see how it is that we get caught in the same reactive patterns. Notice the feeling tone of the relationship. Or we avoid the same kind of person because we carry the memory of the generic sense of that person, maybe their hair or what they wear, and when we see somebody else that holds that particular appearance, we are set to dislike them because we haven't noticed the feeling tone. Start inviting awareness into these moments of mindlessness so that we can begin to really being open. You see, openness depends upon that. When we've already made a judgment call, you know, it's real. This particular area of the country doesn't like to think that they're prejudiced. But if you grew up in the 50s, quite likely you harbor some of that. The feeling tone is still there. It does no one any good not to own that feeling tone and to pretend unprejudicedness. You look at the feeling tone, it doesn't hold up. It will not hold up. It will not, by being honest with it, it will fall apart. By being dishonest with it, it will seethe. So we are called upon to invite more awareness into these feelings so that we don't get caught by the conditioned reflect actions that will feed on these feeling tones, the unawareness of these feeling tones. Where's contentment in that? Where's their contentment in this moment? Regardless of the feeling tone, I can feel it. It's unpleasant, it's hot, it's noisy, it's, I don't know what it is for you. Here we are. Contentment has to be found regardless of the conditions because all conditions change. They're not reliable. We cannot count on life producing pleasant feelings. It's a kaleidoscope of feelings. But when we realize that they are mind engendered rather than thing engendered, we can see where the problem needs to be addressed. I can feel that. So what? The unconditioned is revealed when there is no movement to the feelings of life. When it doesn't really make much difference. Then we know contentment. Then we vote with intelligence. We could just sit for a few minutes. Oh. Okay, if there are any questions or comments, I'd be happy to. Yes. Right. Question is about pleasant emotions like joy and how it's so easy to want to hold on to them and embellish them. I think William Blake said, he who binds himself to joy doth the winged life destroy, but he who kisses joy as it arise lives forever in God's sunrise. Something like that. But there's such wisdom in that, you know. But how do you do that, you see? You don't back away from joy because you suspect that it's something's wrong with it. I was listening to a monk, as a taped interview with a monk, and somebody asked him, what do you do if you see a beautiful sunrise? And he says, I turn my back to it. And I said, well, that's not a teacher I want to study with. Because that's not the point. The point is not to be anti-pleasure. It's not to avoid pleasure. It's to allow pleasure to come and to go. And how you know that you're not doing that is that when it's gone, you will be disturbed because it's gone. You'll try to get the sunrise back the next morning, even though it's a cloudy sky. And there will be suffering in relationship to the attachment you have to that particular emotion. So I say, don't back away from the emotion at all. But just notice that when it dies, what you do. Because it's not to wallow in the emotion. It's not to go, oh God, this is, you know, not to embellish it more than what it is. It's just what it is. You want to be completely clear, but don't make any more than what it is out of it. And have faith. Have faith. You see, the wanting for it to endure is a lack of faith. Okay, what's the next one? What's the next emotion that's coming? Okay, I was joyful all day. I was just, oh, and tomorrow, and I get out of bed tomorrow, it's like, oh, God, oh, I don't even want to be alive today. But yet, okay, so let's go to the feeling tone. What is that? It's an aversive feeling tone now. Okay, I can do it. Now, let's just stay with that. I can do that. I don't have to make it worse than it is. I can just, okay, it's not very pleasant. Irritation or whatever. But I can bring full-hearted aliveness to that as well. So that everything has a right to live. You see, every emotion is looking for its accreditation, for its validation. Everything. Because all of it is part of you. If you deny any aspect of yourself or embellish any particular or lean in any way in whatever it is that's arising, then you aren't fully yourself. You are conjuring up a fantasy of self and trying to live according to that. The point of the meditation is to be fully yourself, which means that emotion, the joy will come and the joy will go. Irritation will come and irritation will go. And the faith that behind all of that is your full aliveness. Your aliveness depends upon all of that. Turn away from anything you've cut or extracted or whittled away part of your aliveness. And the point is to be fully alive. So the only way to do that, we begin to discover, is to be wide open in our willingness to be with whatever arises. Now we hear that 1,000 times. How many times have you heard that? But if we can hear it in a different way, I'm beginning to get it now. Well, of course. We only turn away, you see, this is the problem. We only turn away from something and towards something else when we think what we're turning towards is a better statement of us than what we turn away from. I want to be a joyful person. I want to see people, have people see me as joyful, and I want to be known as a joyful person, and therefore I will hold on to joy when it comes. And so it's a statement of our own sense of egoic standard. Right? And irritation is not. I don't want to be seen as an irritated person. And so that's going to have play less of a role in my life. I'm going to turn away from that. We don't realize that it's the person has nothing to do with it. Throw the whole thing, throw the person out and then deal with what's there. Don't keep personing, which is what the whole point of the five aggregates is. Don't keep wrapping a person around the process. This is a process of life, not a personhood of life. And now we won't deal with it as pertinent. Then we come to our full personhood. Then we wake fully up. Can't wake when we just, because we have divided ourselves into enemy and friends. I've got a group of friends over here which I call joy, happiness, well-being, contentment. I have a group of enemies. And we love enemies and friends because we can battle against the enemies to get over our irritation so that we can join our friends. So we're at war internally. And the more we rub up against life, the more we know ourselves and what we want from it. I want to be a joyful person. So we come down with both feet in that joy. And it better be around tomorrow, by God. He who kisses joy as it flies lives forever in God's sunrise. I can only tell you philosophically how to approach it. Each of us have to move into the direct experience of what these words are pointing to. Don't become so intellectually sophisticated of all the words that they don't invite your experience anymore. That's my fear of those of you who just attend to listen, not attend to practice and integrate what you hear. This is a call for direct experience. Or these words will never be the freedom that they're pointing towards. Sure, that makes sense. I got it now. I know all about feelings. Nothing. You don't know anything about feelings until you invite yourself to see them and how you respond experientially to them. And some of us are far too sophisticated and sophisticated, rich, and practice poor. And if you feel you've done enough reading, build this arm up. Yes. Sure. But you make that decision not based upon feelings, but based upon clarity. The clearer you are, the less you depend upon feelings, the clearer you'll be. The clearer you are, the more discriminating wisdom you'll have. You won't go to the seedy parts of town naively. Not because you hate the seat, not because of aversion, but because you know that there's a chance for whatever to happen. So we don't have enough faith in our clarity. We have faith in what we call intuition. So let's look at this intuition, because usually what we mean by intuition is that we're basing it on a feeling tone. We have this feeling. It's before thought. So I've got this sense of this. Well, yeah, sense, right. If you're greedy, it's going to be one sense. If you're aversive, it's going to be another. If you're deluded, it's like, oh, you're going to be senseless. And then we call that intuition. Intuition is from the unknown. It's not from the conditioned known. There is intuition. But it's not from what most of us think it is. I just have a feeling about that person. God knows where that came from. Probably from their pants or their or their socks or their haircut or the color of their skin. Yes.
I'm troubled about examining the positive feelings, the pleasurable ones.
You're what?
Examining some of the positive feelings.
You're troubled by?
I'm thinking of like,
right.
If I start examining the hobby that gives me pleasure.
Right.
Or my feelings towards my nieces, which are the
right. You're afraid of losing those hobbies?
Yes. Or even scarier is if I had a woman that I was in love with.
Right. Right. Gotcha. Okay, so that's a good question. I love that one. Very honest question. I mean, I love all the questions, but that one, I mean, you feel the honesty in it. Like, he's like, oh, God, I don't want to look at this too close. I don't want to look at the love I have for my wife or the love I have for my niece, because if I start looking at the feeling tones, it may rob me of that love. Your love is not dependent upon that feeling tone. It's dependent upon real connection. If it's dependent upon the feeling tone, it's conditional love. Real interest in a hobby is not conditioned because of the pleasure it may give you, but because of the interest you have in it, which is the proximity of life you have with, the proximity your attention has with life, which is connection. Don't be afraid of doing it. Look at the love you have. See where it is that you lose yourself in romanticism, because that actually tarnishes the love. Don't be afraid of looking at your deep connectedness with life and your loved ones, for fear that you may not, for that love may not be there. Love does not. Love becomes thwarted, blocked. That's how love, when it comes through a feeling tone, then rests on a feeling tone, so that as long as it's a pleasant relationship, I will love you. But then when you do something that is unpleasant to me, my love will be retracted. So look at that. Your love exists prior to the feeling, and it will include all the feelings if it's genuine. And I'm sure your love for your wife and your niece are genuine. Don't be afraid of any of that. Don't let your mind, which is what the big... Don't let your mind block your investigation. Oh, I can't go there. This is a part of life. I can't go there. It's all of it. We have to go into all of it. And if it doesn't hold up, well, then I have to deal with that mess. You see, it's with that spirit, and I really appreciate the question, I think when we expose those kinds of questions that all of us have, then the secret part of us that won't go to a certain area of life gets exposed, so we can all feel a little more relaxed. Okay, good. I'll even look at that one. What do I mean by love? What do I mean by loving my wife? What do I mean by loving my child? What do I mean by that? What's going on there? That will only bring greater faith. It will not bring separation and disconnection. You will love asking the questions, because you know that your life will never be based upon dependency of conditions. And once the props are all eliminated, you will feel the surgence in your heart of faith and love. So let us not be afraid to ask those questions or to invite that kind of investigation. Any other? Yes.
Curious about the
Is it what?
What causes it?
Right. The question is about the deluded state and what causes it. What causes it is that is dependency upon intensity or stimulation. Most of us live a life in which we fill it with stimulation. And when it's not stimulated, our liveness depends upon stimulation for us to... And we carry them in our belt, you know, our pager and our walkie-talkies and our... PDAs. It all gives us a sense of stimulation, of self-importance. Try walking around with your belt free. Let your pants... And so when we don't have that stimulation, we don't feel... I mean, this often happens on retreat. When, you know, all the stimulations have been eliminated and we're stuck there without anything enticing us. And our mind implodes upon itself. It goes into daydreaming. It goes into a fantasy tree. It goes anywhere to stimulate something because this moment is not worth paying attention to. It holds nothing. It holds only the habitual, the already seen, the known. Nothing worth connecting to. That's where delusion comes from. Now, if it were true, I would say, may your cell phone forever ring. But it's not true. But we have to be willing to go through the pain of boredom, the unpleasantness of boredom, which for some of us is the... Oh my, that's Mara. That's the worst it could get. Isn't it amazing? We're so affluent that the worst it could get is boredom. Isn't that amazing? Jeez. Where are we going to recover that moment? That moment is the only moment in which you live. Period. When are we going to... You never will recover it. Never recover it. You were dying, it wouldn't be boring. You'd find something really interesting to focus in on if you were dying. If I told you that this world was going to blow up in 30 seconds, you wouldn't reach for your cell phone, you wouldn't have time. You'd be alive like that. Okay, so we have to stop for this evening. Thank you.